Well, good evening and welcome to the final sessional meeting of this 2006 to 2007 session. Copies of the minutes of the ordinary general meeting held on the 30th of April 2007 have been displayed on the Institute notice board and will be taken as read. May I sign the minutes as a correct record? Yes, good. Thank you very much. May I extend a particular welcome to Paul Seymour, Chairman of the Board for Actuarial Standards, and personal guests of members. Now, we have a prize to present for the IUA prize for general insurance, but there seems to be some doubt as to whether the prize winner is here or not. Is Lee Harris in the hall? Yes, he is. Good. Okay, right. Excellent. In that case, then, I'm delighted to present a prize to Lee Harris of the Royal Bank of Scotland. Lee is the winner of the International Underwriting Association General Insurance Fellowship Prize, awarded to the best performing student in Subject 403, the UK Fellowship General Insurance paper, for the September 2006 examination diet. And this award has been funded by the IUA. So I'd now like to ask Lee to step forward so that I can present him with his certificate. I don't know what happened to the cheque, but no doubt it will find its way. Right, now before we start the main event of the evening, I'd just like to mention a few housekeeping issues. First of all, this meeting is being filmed to produce a webcast, and we're hoping to make the webcast available to members only from Friday of this week. Secondly, the fire alarm for this building is a continuous ringing alarm. And should this go off during the meeting, please make your way calmly and efficiently to the assembly point, which is outside the Melton Mowbray Public House. And I imagine that there are enough people who know where the Melton Mowbray Public House is to help those who don't to get there. Anyone who'd like to claim CPD for this meeting should make sure that they sign the forms that are being circulated on clipboards during the meeting. And finally, can I also ask you to turn off your BlackBerries and mobile phones, because the signals for both of those interfere with our sound system. And just to be clear, it's not good enough just to turn it to mute or silent. Because the machine will still try to talk to its base, and it's that that causes the buzzing on the loudspeakers. Thank you very much. Right, now, the main topic for this evening, then, is a discussion on a paper by Duncan Anderson, Clive Bolton, Gary Callan, Martin Cross, Sherry Howard, Grant Mitchell, Carl Murphy, James Rako, Gabriel Welsh, and Peter Sterling, entitled General Insurance Premium Rating, The Way Forward. And I'd now like to invite Duncan Anderson to introduce the paper.
Mr. President, ladies and gentlemen, as one who has spent much of his career involved in general insurance pricing, I'm delighted that we have the opportunity this evening to discuss and debate the profession's activities in this area. I fully recognise that general insurance pricing is not a self-contained activity. It obviously overlaps with work in the reserving, capital modelling and many other areas. And it is just one actuarial element of the successful management of an insurance operation. Nevertheless, I think that to focus on pricing issues, as we've been asked to do over the last couple of years and as we will do this evening, is useful in drawing out some issues, many of which have wider ramifications. In our paper, we make a number of recommendations. Some are quite specific, some more wide-ranging. We discuss the role of the pricing actuary, how this has changed over recent years, skills that may be needed going forward. We've discussed methods which are used in general insurance premium rating and potential areas for further research. We've discussed issues around communication and professional guidance. But I think one thing that came clear to us quite early on in our discussions was that although each of these things has resulted in standalone recommendations, many of these ultimately point to the profession's education and CPD programme being enhanced in one way or another. In addition, we were specifically asked to review the content of the examination syllabus and CPD options from a pricing perspective, which we've done, and that has led to further recommendations in this area. And I think with so many things pointing to education, there are some broader questions which are raised, which are rather outside our remit, but maybe worthy of debate this evening. Questions such as, how much should the profession's education and CPD programme cover? How much technical detail should be in the examination syllabus? To what extent should we as a profession be seeking to train our members in non-technical skills, such as communication skills? And associated with this, the old chestnut of the degree to which it is appropriate that the UK actuarial qualification is specialised in subject areas. The more we put general insurance premium rating matter into the examination syllabus, the more we go down a road of a specialist general insurance qualification, something which I know many here may be keen on happening, but something which is certainly not without issues, and something which may be worthy of debate this evening. A second theme I wanted to draw out this evening was that during our discussions, we returned again and again to the topic of whether there is an increasing potential conflict with the need for actuaries to hold strong governance roles, with the desire for both actuaries and our stakeholders for us to hold value-adding management positions in pricing. The feedback from our stakeholders was clear. They would like to see actuaries more involved with the business, more at the coalface, more involved in making decisions. Yet the feedback we've had from many practitioners is quite clear that many are concerned that current professional guidance could make this more difficult. I think this is something which has been discussed in Australia. It was with great interest that we learned of the Institute of Actuaries of Australia's approach to professional guidance. There they have a two-hat approach, where activities are clearly distinguished between certain types of formal reporting work and more day-to-day professional services, with different types of guidance applying to each of those modes quite clearly. This applies not just at the general insurance level in Australia, but across the entire profession, so equivalent to our PCS level. We think that this approach has a number of key attractions to pricing actuaries, and notwithstanding the fact that this has implications across the whole of the profession and not just general insurance, let alone premium rating, we recommend that the profession debate the merits of this approach with the Board for Actuarial Standards. Of course, since making that recommendation, the BAS has published its preliminary consultation paper discussing a potential conceptual framework for technical standards going forward. Reading some of the ideas there, some of the ideas around technical standards applying to output rather than to individuals, the distinction between actuarial information and actuarial advice, and the concept of work having a stamp saying SAPT, Standard Actuarial Principles and Techniques, it seems to me that whilst not exactly the same as the Australian approach, there is potential there for these thoughts to evolve into something which achieves materially the same benefits. The fact that it was a discussion with an Australian actuary that led us to think about this two-hat approach leads me to my third and final observation in this introduction, which is that during our work we've had many discussions with actuarial bodies overseas. And whilst each market has its own particular issues, I think it's interesting to note that many of the themes we discuss have strong parallels overseas. In particular, the discussions around the changing role of the actuary and the conflict between governance and management is something which seemed to have a particular resonance in the USA and in Australia. As well as a resonance, there was also, I'm pleased to say, an enthusiasm internationally to help take forward some of our recommendations. In particular, a number of very senior CAS people have expressed an interest in participating in establishing a premium rating manual in the form of a wiki. Now, With URLs only having very recently been allowed into sessional papers, the idea of a definitive grand wiki may seem a little ambitious, but during the consultation process, it was clear that there was significantly more enthusiasm and support for this idea than there was scepticism. And if we can harness this support and achieve a critical mass of interest, then this technological innovation may allow an international collaboration which has been hitherto impractical and unseen. Views on this, and indeed all our recommendations in the paper, would be very welcome this evening. Perhaps the most important thing I wanted to do this evening, though, is say thank you. Many people were involved in putting together this paper. In addition to the 10 authors, some 20 individuals participated in work streams and various meetings, some 17 senior stakeholders were interviewed, and many people during the consultation process have fed in feedback. On behalf of the Working Party, I would like wholeheartedly to thank everyone who's made a contribution. I very much hope that we have expressed the feedback adequately in our paper and that the resulting paper is of some interest and use to the profession. Mr. President, ladies and gentlemen, we very much look forward to the discussion.
Thank you, Duncan. I'd now like to ask Derek Newton to open the discussion, please.
Thank you, President, ladies and gentlemen. I am the chairman of the General Insurance Board, and it's in that capacity that I'm speaking to you tonight. It was the General Insurance Board that originally commissioned the review of actuarial pricing, pricing, which has led to the paper that is being discussed tonight. Now, whilst as chairman I'd like to take credit for all that, I have to say that I am the current chairman. It's a two-year post which you have here, and it was actually during the tenure of my predecessor, indeed at the instigation of my predecessor, that this particular review was started. And so I'd like to give credit to David Hindley for his foresight in promoting this. Now, the origins of the review was largely down to the General Insurance Reserving Issues Task Force, which is also better known by the acronym GRIT, rather similar to the acronym for the Pricing Task Force, which I think reflects a lack of imagination probably on the part of general insurance actuaries. Now, GRIT was commissioned by the board in 2004, mostly in response to perceived criticisms of reserving for general insurance, general insurers coming from the US. We were keen at the time to see if such criticisms could also be applied to reserving in the UK, and if so, how we should address such criticism. Now, it quickly became apparent to us that the task force had assumed a rather wider remit and was already generating some fascinating material, which was eventually summarised in a paper which was discussed at a meeting here in, I think, March of last year. Seeing the quality of the work which GRIT was generating and the potential for it to lead to significant improvements in actuarial involvement in reserving, the board decided to launch a sister task force, this time focusing on actuarial involvement in general insurance pricing, and hence GRIP was born. Now, having commissioned GRIP, the General Insurance Board felt it was probably appropriate for us to discuss the final report ahead of this meeting, and in particular, we wanted to discuss the recommendations. Our conclusion was that we broadly support them. Now, I say broadly, not because there's any sort of qualification about that, but we're also aware that at that stage, the recommendations, the final paper itself, had not actually been exposed to a wider audience. And what we were keen to do is to hear the views of a wider audience, particularly non-actuarial stakeholders. And from that, the feedback that we'd get from that, we would then refine the recommendations along with the GRIP team and also provide some sort of implementation program. I believe that this meeting is an excellent opportunity for interested parties to contribute their views. Now, turning to the recommendations, the findings of the recommendations themselves, I do note that Duncan has already done an extremely erudite job of setting them out, and so I'll just focus on one or two aspects of it. First of all, although they covered very different aspects of general insurance work, I do note that the GRIP and the GRIT reports had much in common. One of the things which I'm particularly delighted to know is that, notwithstanding the various comments which were made subsequently, the initial fact finding resulted in very warm feedback to both of the task force, indicating that in general, our stakeholders like what we do and the way that we do it. However, both reports also highlighted certain issues, Ones in common were education, continuing professional development, and communication. Now, starting off with the issue of education, the board's already taken notice of a large number of the identified gaps within the examination syllabus and the various perceived shortcomings of the existing educational material. It has, as a result, embarked on a fundamental rewrite of this material, which is a project which I should say has involved about 20 employers of general insurance actuaries volunteering the services of their employees, for which I'd like to thank everybody who's involved at this stage. It's already been a long task, and it's going to be quite a long task to finish it off from here. It seems to us quite obvious that the resultant material will be quite a lot larger than the existing material, and there may need to be a split of the existing specialties examinations into two to accommodate the new material. This, unfortunately, has wider ramifications than just general insurance, and as such, no firm decision has yet been taken. But again, this is an area which I'd appreciate people's views on tonight. Now, the difficulty the actuaries have in communicating with their stakeholders is also a topic which is rather wider than just general insurance. It's an accusation which has been levelled at the profession for many years. And in my opinion, the position is probably less bad than it was 20 years ago, but it's still not perfect. However, as I say, it's improved, and a lawyer who was a guest at the General Insurance Convention in September last year in Vienna said to me that it was nonsense that actuaries couldn't communicate. Speaker after speaker at the convention had actually demonstrated how well actuaries speak when they speak to other actuaries. The problem is getting the message across to non-actuaries, and this is where I think we still have a problem. I think there's maybe two routes to this problem. First of all, when I was at school, and I admit this is some time ago, and so things may have changed since then. When it came to sciences, we were taught formulae, we were taught theorems, we were taught lemmas. When it came to linguistics, we were taught about the richness of language, we were taught the power of visual imagery. Reading Shakespeare, Hardy, Pinter, whatever, improved my understanding of great literature, but I think it's been of little use to me when I've been trying to explain uncertainty in distributions to an underwriter. And that, I think, is one of the problems. Secondly, the incomprehensible nature of actuarial communication is renowned, and therefore many non-actuaries start from the basis that they will not understand what they're being told. And as a result, I think some of them probably don't really bother. Therefore, the premise becomes self-fulfilling. Again, I'll be interested to know what people's views are as to how we overcome these fundamental difficulties. Turning to something that wasn't in the grit paper but has been covered by the pricing team. As Duncan says, they've identified some possible adverse effects of the current professional guidance upon actuaries operating in the pricing role. Now, this is particularly concerning to me because the guidance which the board put in place, we went through an extensive revision process to the guidance before we passed it over to the board for actuarial standards. The intention of this was, if anything, to increase the perceived value of actuarial work in general. And by setting minimum standards by which the stakeholders could expect actuaries to deliver their work. It was certainly not intended that it became a burden that would prevent actuaries from doing a good job. Now, Duncan's mentioned that the Australian actuaries have a two-hat approach to professional guidance, and this seems to me to have considerable potential. So, again, if anybody here has practical experience of this two-hat regime, or indeed of anything else which is of similar nature which could work, I would again be grateful if they're prepared to share it at this meeting. Meanwhile, in response to criticisms which have been levelled against Guidance Note 12, in particular, the one about actuarial reporting, the board has started having a review of the way that this actually operates, and we hope to be able to report sometime in the autumn on this. Now, as Duncan has highlighted, there are many other interesting thoughts and ideas within this paper and many other recommendations. Unfortunately, there are too many for us all to deal with all in one go, and therefore the next stage will be to prioritise them and then to draw up an implementation plan. Having commissioned the report and having accepted the recommendations, it is right that this should be led by the General Insurance Board, closely assisted, I hope, by Duncan and whichever or whoever of his GRIP team would like to stay on for the ride. The discussion tonight, I hope, will help us to prioritise and plan that implementation. In conclusion, I regard this as a very important paper, not only for general insurance pricing actuaries, but also for the profession as a whole. I'm delighted to have been able to open the discussion this evening and also be able to both thank and to congratulate the authors of this on their paper. We have a lot to learn from this paper and a lot to do to implement its conclusions. I think the General Insurance Board is up for the challenge. I hope you're all up now for the discussion. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Derek. Now, the discussion is open to the floor. I have some names of people who put their name down to speak in advance. But can I just ask, apart from those people who've done that, how many other people would like to contribute to the discussion this evening, or might like to contribute? One, two. Come on, don't be shy. Yeah, three, four, good. Right, okay, that's helpful, thank you very much. I should say you shouldn't be deterred from contributing, because you'll be given the opportunity to see any comments you make before they're published in the BAJ. Roving microphones are available this evening, but you have a choice. You can either come to the lectern at the front or wait for a microphone to be brought to you if you'd like to speak from the body of the hall. And can you please state your name clearly before making your contribution? So can I ask Catherine Morgan to speak next? Is Catherine here? Yes, good. And after Catherine, James Tanzer.
Thank you. Catherine Morgan. Very much enjoyed reading the group paper. It's a very good paper and very thought-provoking, and I'd like to give my thanks to all the authors who've done a lot of hard work. I mentioned it's thought-provoking, and it made me think about why the grit and grip papers seem to me to end up in a different place. I think readers of both might come to the conclusion that actuaries are positioned differently in reserving and pricing. Reserving seems to have a very widely recognised role for actuaries. People in industry, people across the profession would recognise that general insurance actuaries are good at reserving, and they're the people you should turn to. And in fact, looking at the Solvency II consultations, actuarial methodology, actuarial roles are mentioned all across the Solvency II documents that have come out. And of course, you need to know how good your reserves are in order to do a solvency assessment for a company. But in my view, pricing has just as much impact on the solvency of a general insurer. If you write the wrong risks at the wrong price, then you're probably going to go bust. So, and also, the current assessment of your profit does feed into how you work out your capital. If you think about future profit from current business or even future new business, you can take account of that when working out how much capital you need. So incorrect pricing may lead to insolvency through bad decisions or by giving you too little capital. So should we as a profession be pushing for more regulation around pricing along the lines of what there may be in reserving with Solvency II? Should we be pushing for a statutory or a recognised role for actuaries in pricing? Should we be pushing for approval of premium rates, perhaps at an overall level rather than individually? And should we be pushing for assumptions on pricing to be published? To be honest, this seems to me like a bad idea. It seems to be against a free market principle, which is what we have in the UK on general insurance. And consumers should be able to choose which products they want to buy from which insurance company. But should we be asking, have they got the expertise to do that? Do they know enough about how general insurance companies work? And the move from selling through general insurance brokers who can advise consumers about the solvency of general insurance companies, through to call centres and now aggregator sites where people are buying personal lines insurance based on price rather than the security of the insurer, it puts more of the responsibility onto the individual policyholder. And whilst they might think they're buying a one-year motor insurance certificate, if they make a claim, it could actually be a 20-year commitment that they're making. Now, GRIP hasn't tackled this, which I think reflects perhaps a reactive approach on behalf of the profession to pricing and General Insurance Actuaries' roles in pricing. Personally, I'm not uncomfortable with that, but it has made me think about whether I should be uncomfortable and whether perhaps all of us should be a bit uncomfortable about that. Thank you.
James Tanzer and then Peter Hinton, please.
James Tanzer. Mr. President, ladies and gentlemen, I'd first like to start by adding my thanks to all those who worked on this excellent paper, in particular those people who perhaps didn't quite make it onto the acknowledgements page. I know there are lots of people out there who worked very hard, so thank you one and all. As I specialise in the area of personal lines pricing, I think I'm going to confine my comments to that area. I'd like to start by saying that my experience very much agrees with the view given in the paper, which is that when multivariate techniques are first introduced, it's often done by actuaries. But after that, the work is often passed on to other professionals, such as statisticians. I think it's clearly in all of our interests, and the interest of the profession as a whole, that we should continue to try to find new ways to add value to the pricing process so that we can continue to work here and don't find our jobs taken away. The current trend possibly in this area is for companies to start looking to price optimisation in order to mine the value in the portfolio. While some UK companies are very well placed to look at individual price optimisation at the point of sale even, many other companies, both at home and abroad, are not in that fortunate position, either because of constraints in the way they sell the policies or by regulatory constraints. Nonetheless, I think it's very clear that even in very highly regulated markets, it's possible that some form of price optimisation can help both insurance companies and intermediaries improve their overall performance. And I look forward to further research being done in this area. I think it's also very important that we don't get too entrenched on our own particular specialities. While obviously I specialise in non-life personal lines, I've also worked recently with colleagues in other areas applying the common techniques, GLMs and GAMs, to, for example, London market data and indeed to annuitant mortality. I think, again, we should be seeking to spread our experience to other people, help other actuaries in the profession outside the general insurance to use the techniques that we're familiar with, and indeed to be open to new ideas from elsewhere in the profession. Finally, I'd like to commend the suggestion in the paper that we pursue the idea of data pooling in a similar way to the ISO is doing in the US, whether be that through existing bodies like the ABI or through a new JARO working party or subcommittee. In addition to this, I'd like to go a little bit further and maybe making data available to academia at large. So, for instance, I'm thinking about a large anonymised database of a few million records of perhaps motor or household experience. Of course, consultancies and indeed insurance companies have large databases lying around, and it's very easy for us to go away and do our own research. But the results of this research are often not published, and where they are published, the data underlying the research normally isn't available for other people to review. In the past, I've worked on JARO working parties where we have used pooled data, but in this case, we were actually forbidden by the terms of engagement to save the data after the end of the analysis we performed. I think it would be useful to the future of the profession if a database wasn't made available to academia. It would greatly aid researchers if there was more data available, and then I think everyone here would benefit from the results of this research. Thank you all.
Peter Hinton and then Sanjeev Chandaria.
Mr. President, ladies and gentlemen, my name is Peter Hinton. I'd like to thank the authors for a timely, useful and readable paper. And I'd like to take the opportunity to say something about the wider horizons of Solvency II. And to illustrate these remarks, I'd like to refer to a couple of paragraphs in the paper. Firstly, Paragraph 3.29 discusses integration with internal capital assessments. It should go without saying that an internal model that does not use fully the information from the pricing department on expected losses and on the variability of losses is, to that extent, inadequate. It should go without saying that premium pricing that does not use the information from the internal model on capital requirements and the cost of capital or on the other needs of the business plan is, to that extent, less useful than it might be. The FSA knows that insurers generally need to do more to integrate their internal models into their planning processes. That is, they do not currently fully meet the use test, or at least they don't all currently meet the use test. Paragraph 331 notes that expense loading is often done simplistically or using models developed for other purposes. By implication, this is not done as well as it should be. As most of you know, Solvency II offers a prospect that a firm can use its own internal model to calculate its solvency capital requirements, provided that it can demonstrate to the regulator that the model meets the standards for approval. These standards include the use test and also statistical quality tests and a calibration test. Since there would not normally be a supervisory add-on, and the test is improved in advance, rather than simply evaluated in use, the standards will inevitably be much higher than for internal models under ICAS. The example of expenses is just one area where most insurers will need to do considerable work to meet the statistical quality tests, and the work needs to start now if there is to be adequate data by the time Solvency II is implemented. One of the advantages for a firm of an internal model, and by that I mean to include also partial models covering just premium risk, is that it should allow reduced capital requirements in a hard market instead of the higher requirements that may result from a standard formula that uses premiums as an exposure measure. An advantage for the supervisor is the higher capital requirement the internal model would deliver in a soft market. I, of course, assume that no sensible, well-run firm would object to this.
Sanjeev Chandaria. Let me start by also passing on my congratulations and thanks to the Working Party and all who assisted the Working Party for producing this comprehensive, timely and well-written paper on this important subject. It's particularly pleasing to see that the Working Party has consulted widely with not only UK actuaries, but also the US and Australian actuarial bodies, and probably more importantly, non-actuarial professionals and stakeholders in the pricing and underwriting process. I'd like to make comments on three aspects of the paper. Firstly, the section on pricing methods currently in use. Secondly, the related areas of CPD education and professional guidance. And finally, some thoughts on the commercial environment in which we actually operate. So starting with the pricing methods. The main pricing methods commonly in use in the personal lines, commercial lines, and London markets are very well documented in the paper and would naturally form the backbone of revised educational and CPD material. I'm also supportive of the use of a wiki model as it would continue to allow many different parties to participate going forward. However, whilst the Working Party has recommended a long list of research topics, these will, and probably are, being prioritised as there is still likely to be a scarcity of actuarial resources to undertake the research. Intellectual capital concerns may also arise, making it difficult to research the newest areas such as price optimization. In addition, the priorities are likely to vary between the markets. So, for example, for the London market, the most pressing research topics may be perhaps say integration with ICA and catastrophe models. The Working Party has made extensive recommendations on updating the exam syllabus and CPD material. I agree with all these points and would emphasise the need for more education on insurance products and terminology, which is well covered by the Chartered Insurance Institute. I think this is particularly important for those working in the London market, where having a thorough understanding of the contract being priced is an essential element of the pricing approach. Regarding professional guidance, I would endorse the need for more information and assistance notes, but I would temper that thought by urging that the need for more guidance is balanced against the potential situation of having, let's say, perhaps too many rules and regulations that may stifle innovation and creativity. My final comments relate to the practical implementation of actual pricing approaches in the commercial environment. As I noted previously, the GRIP Working Party's paper is comprehensive, and if many of the recommendations are implemented, should result in an improvement in the actuarial profession's skills and capabilities and provide more value to the users of such skills. There is, however, one challenge that I would put to the Working Party. Have the recommendations given sufficient consideration to the requirements of the users of actuarial services? In particular, a common theme is that they would like the actuary to be more involved throughout the underwriting process, rather than just fulfil a technical pricing role. By way of example, in 2006, Lloyd's introduced the Lloyd's Underwriting Management Standards, which provided guidance and minimum standards to improve underwriting standards across the market. Technical pricing formed one part of those standards, but the standards also covered underwriting strategy, planning, underwriting and controls, and exposure management and assessment, amongst other areas. Have actuaries been sufficiently involved in all of these other areas? So one final question I will leave you with. Do the Working Party's recommendations go far enough to enable actuaries to have the necessary technical and soft skills to contribute effectively in all parts of the underwriting process and become a more integral part of the senior management team? Thank you.
Can I now invite Neil Chapman, who I think wants to make a contribution on behalf of the colleague, to speak? And then after Neil, Ryan Warren.
I am Neil Chapman. I'm reading on behalf of Liz Michael, who couldn't be here today, and she says, Sections 2.4.1 and 7 make reference to the conflicting roles of a pricing actuary and highlighting the Australian two-hat model as a possible approach to resolving this conflict. I would like to support the view of the authors that there is an issue balancing two potentially conflicting roles, that of governance and that of pricing management. The Australian model, or something similar, would appear to provide a way forward in resolving this conflict and in clarifying an actuary's role. Similarly, the report alludes to different and often conflicting requirements between GN50, which requires that communication be in an appropriate manner and tailored to the audience, and GN12, which stipulates that another experienced actuary should be able to reproduce all aspects of the analysis based on the detail provided, even when the intended audience is not another experienced actuary. The audiences for formal reports often do not require or want the volume of details stipulated by GN12, and prefer a higher level style that is easier to digest. Adoption of a system similar to the two-hat model would facilitate also the adoption of guidance tailored to the advice being given. On education, the report provides a thorough comparison of GI actuarial education in several territories, section 5.28 onwards. In my view, there is a case for increasing the depth of material covered in the UK exams and additionally making this further material available to qualified to use a CPD if appropriate to them. Thanks.
Mr. President, ladies and gentlemen, Ryan Warren. I'd first like to congratulate the members of the Working Party and all those providing their assistance on a very well-written and comprehensive paper. Well done, and thank you to all.
For this afternoon's sessional meeting, I'd just like to briefly comment on the issues around the role of the actuary, communication and guidance. And I've always been particularly excited about the role actuaries play or could play in pricing. This is one of the clear areas in which actuaries can have a direct and significant influence on the profitability of the company. But to be successful in this role and to be taken seriously by other stakeholders in the business, the actuary needs to be seen to really understand the business and market and to be entrepreneurially minded with similar commercial drivers to the rest of the company. As suggested in the paper, the role of the actuary has changed significantly over the past 10 years. It seems to me from my own experience that companies and underwriters are much more inclined to work alongside actuaries than they were in the past and often proactively seek out the input of actuaries when setting premiums. In the future, though, the roles and tasks performed by the actuaries are likely to be affected by internal structural processes around corporate governance and risk management. And the challenges now facing actuaries wishing to increase their role include improving technical skills, improving the understanding of an integration into the business and communication. And much of the image that actuaries have in their own companies and the market is affected by what and how they communicate. And poor communication leads others to believe that actuaries do not understand their business and are not aligned with the interests of the company. While I agree with the recommendation of the paper that a glossary of terms be constructed for actuaries to use in their correspondence with others, actuaries should also be learning and using terminology actually used within their wider business environment. In general, I think actuaries are quite good at written communication, but verbal and presentational communication is arguably more important in this area. Most people involved in the pricing process are not interested in or have time to read a large formal report and or base their views on what they are actually told. And I think this is an area where actuaries are less good. These communication issues also link into professional guidance. In many ways, these two pressures act against each other at present, as actuaries are required to provide an enormous quantity of information without much emphasis on how that information is presented or received. The guidance should bear in mind the impact that the requirements on the clarity of the advice. Any reporting requirements need to balance the needs of the end user with the requirement that other professionals should be able to form a view of the reasonableness of the work done. So developmental sessions to assist actuaries in developing their communication, presentational, influencing and negotiation skills, and also interpret the current guidance in context would really, really help. Maybe such a sessional meeting or session can be included as part of the suggested annual premium rating seminar. Finally, onerous guidance on the pricing actuary can reduce the ability of the company to react quickly to market changes. In these cases, companies would prefer to look at alternative, less onerous sources of advice. So the working party's suggestion of recognising the need for separate guidance for actuaries in business and those in public service under a two-hat approach sounds really reasonable to me. Maybe in the interim, further clarity on the correct interpretation of the current guidance in relation to pricing would suffice.
Right, now we've gone through my list of speakers who put their names down in advance, so who would like to go next?
Hello, I'm Guy Thomas. I want to pick up on something Catherine Morgan said. She asked whether you should feel uncomfortable about certain things. Yes, I think perhaps you should, and perhaps I'm going to make you feel uncomfortable. We'll see. I intend to say something about Section 8 of the full Working Party report, treating customers fairly. And I have written to the Working Party about this, so they have notice. In particular, I am going to say something about Sections 8.12 to 17, which are headed utility pricing. I think more accurate headings might be deception pricing or scam pricing. Now, deception pricing seems to include a range of scams, but the most obvious one is charging customers whom you think are more trusting an extortionate renewal premium. I don't think there's any serious argument that this is fair, and I note that the Working Party doesn't offer any positive arguments, but merely notes that the FSA hasn't taken much interest yet. But the whole point of treating customers fairly, the FSA initiative, is that instead of micro-regulation of every aspect of every transaction, firms have an obligation to consider treating customers fairly in a proactive way. And if we consider fairness proactively, we can make a number of comparisons and analogies, and I think deception pricing looks very bad on all of them. So I'm going to make five comparisons. First comparison is with plumbers and repairmen. Some plumbers quote inflated prices for standard services to customers whom they think are more trusting. For example, older people living alone. And the usual description for those plumbers is that they're rogue traders or con men. Second comparison, insurance is a contract of utmost good faith. I always find it rather strange that actuaries seem to construe this obligation as falling mainly on the insured and hardly at all on the insurer. But it's difficult to see how an insurer practicing deception pricing can be characterised as acting in good faith. They're clearly acting in bad faith. Third comparison is with other public pronouncements of the actuarial profession. The profession often makes assertions in the nature of people expect to pay a premium appropriate for their own risk and not to subsidise others. That is a direct quote from the profession's briefing statement on genetics and insurance, and that seems clearly inconsistent with deception pricing. My fourth comparison is with reports of other meetings in this hall. I often read actuaries bemoaning the difficulties created by a lack of public trust in insurance companies and actuaries. Apparently, this creates difficulties for with-profit insurance, and the difficulty which insurers have in relation to genetic tests is partly caused by a lack of trust, and so on. And I read very eminent actuaries opining that the proper role of a profession should be to proactively limit deception or proactively limit obfuscation. Well, in relation to deception pricing, the profession doesn't seem to be doing that. It appears to be endorsing deception and obfuscation. My fifth comparison is with the mortgage market. It's very common in the mortgage market for there to be an initial discount for the first year or two of a mortgage. And that is priced on a sort of utility basis, that it's expected some customers will remortgage, but many will not. But unlike insurance pricing, that isn't based on deception. The initial discount is quite clearly specified, and not just in the headline, not just in small print, but in the headline. So that's my five comparisons. And I think that last comparison gives the clue as to what is required for utility pricing to be characterised as treating customers fairly. What is required is disclosure. Next to the inflated renewal premium, there should be a clear statement. For example, this premium is X pounds higher than we would charge for a new customer. If you want a premium for a new customer, you should try other insurers. You may laugh, but you're living in a different world to me. Now, the Working Party, I'm sure, is also living in a different world to me, and when I contacted the Working Party about deception pricing, one of the things they said to me was that this was not a purely actuarial issue, and therefore the profession couldn't act alone. Well, I want to say clearly that that is quite specious. The profession very often does act alone on matters which are not purely actuarial issues. For example, in this field of general insurance, the profession has, for some years, been campaigning against the rights and interests of accident victims, deriding what it calls a compensation culture, and I prefer to call a justice culture. Now, I deplore that campaign, but it is a very clear example that the profession can act alone on a matter which is not purely actuarial. To come back to deception pricing, I will leave you with this thought. In the absence of adequate promotion of disclosure by a regulator or by the profession, the second best route to promoting fair treatment of customers is going to be publicity. Perhaps the Sunday Times or the Mail on Sunday will start a campaign, or perhaps the Treasury Select Committee can be persuaded to take an interest. The profession should consider carefully whether it would be happy for its complicity in deception pricing to be reported prominently in a national newspaper, in an article written by an accurate but unfriendly reporter. Sooner or later, that is going to happen. Thank you.
Thank you, Guy. Who's going to be next? Yes, down here. There we are.
President, ladies and gentlemen, first of all, my name is Anna Mata. I would like to congratulate the Working Party for a great paper. I think it's a step forward in the right direction, but I think there are a lot of gaps that need to be covered in the next month. I will limit the discussion to commercial and London market lines, which is the area of my expertise. If I read the paper correctly, it kind of promotes the role of a pricing actuary in an individual risk pricing role. I think that's very limiting in a way, because unless actuaries price each risk in an insurance company, I'm not sure the impact of the actuary in the overall profitability is strong enough. If a company writes $500 million and their pricing actually only influences $5 million or $10 million, I don't know that that will have a big impact in the overall bottom line. It is actually a very difficult role to maintain in a softening market, because using simple actuarial techniques, every year the actuarial rate is higher just by simple math, but the market is going the other way around. I think, having worked in a pricing role for many years, actually should, in a non-reinsurance context, actually should be doing more reporting and less individual risk pricing. Because one thing that I didn't find in the report is the role of actuaries in three fundamental management reports that I think every underwriter should have: rate monitoring, the new versus renewal price differential, and the adequacy of rate as opposed to the rate change on its own. So that's my view. In terms of communication, I think the problem is not so much the communication skills, but the lack of product knowledge. If you're talking to an underwriter about a specific line of business, but you don't know what's going on in that line, it makes it difficult to come out of the math behind the standard models and relay the pricing you're coming up with to the market. Because every year, as I say, you will need more in terms of rate, but if there is something affecting the line outside the actuarial models that you should know and incorporate in the pricing, then you will be able to communicate your results better. In a soft market, I think underwriters are starting to challenge more on the assumptions of claims inflations, how much weight to give experience, how much weight to give to exposure. And those challenges were not there in 2003, 2004. Now, if you use 7% inflation in 2003, it was fine. Now they say, well, we're using 7 and not 3. Because they need to get to a price. So I think all this knowledge of the lines of business will help actuaries to position better with the underwriting management. That's just my view. Thank you.
David Hart, yeah.
Mr. President, ladies and gentlemen, my name is David Hart. I should like to add my congratulations to the Working Party, to those already voiced by previous speakers. They've covered a wide-ranging field very thoroughly, and I wholly endorse the majority of their recommendations. I would like to comment briefly on two specific sections of the paper, Section 2 and Section 4. I have two comments on the role of the actuary in pricing. The first relates to the reasons why actuaries have been recruited to underwriting organisations in the London market. I think there are two additional factors which deserve a mention and were certainly significant in the development of the actuary's pricing role in Lloyd's and the London market in the early to mid-1980s, when this was very much a new field of work for the profession. The first of these factors is competition. The only reason why insurers or reinsurers, whether they were companies or Lloyd's syndicates, would wish to employ the relatively expensive actuaries in this new role was that they believed or hoped that this would give them a competitive advantage in what is, after all, an extremely competitive marketplace. The second factor, and this is to some extent also related to competition, is that for reinsurance business particularly, and particularly that emanating from the United States, the reinsured almost invariably had an actuarial report prepared either by the in-house actuary or by a consultant hired for the purpose on the business being ceded. The London Market underwriter wanted someone else who could understand it and provide a critical comment on it to ensure that the reinsurer wasn't being ripped off. The second point on the role of the actuary in pricing is that there are several references to the downgrading of the actuary's position from that previously enjoyed. I seriously question this. With the exception of one or two organisations, it is my perception that the actuary has never been more than one of a group involved in the process, and rarely the head honcho who made the final decision. The situation does not appear to have changed much from my perspective. With regard to Section 4, I wholeheartedly endorse the working party's views that much more pricing material should be included in the education. But in my view, it is only sustainable if there is a second general insurance paper, or third or whatever, but certainly not on one paper. Otherwise, there are two options. Other material would have to be removed, which I believe to be a total non-starter, or the examiners have an impossible task in trying to test the knowledge of far too much material in one exam. In addition, although I hadn't made notes on this, I would like to wholly endorse Ryan's comments about communication. I think that whilst general insurance actuaries have, in my view, a better ability to communicate with non-actuaries than many of the life and pensions people, they do, after all, have a lot more experience at doing it, there is still considerable room for improvement. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, David. Who'd like to go next? While people are collecting their thoughts, would any member of the working party like to respond to anything that's been said so far? Well, I just was thinking that if you respond now, it might prompt some further comment from the audience.
I'll respond to most of the points a little bit later in closing, but to respond to Guy Thomas's point about utility pricing, or deception pricing, to use his terminology. Guy did send us an email as part of the consultation process, which I think was pretty much what he said here today. So we did send Guy a reply to that, and I've got it here, so perhaps I could read that out. Dear Guy, thank you for your comments in relation to the General Insurance Premium Rating Issues Working Party, and in particular in relation to the section on treating customers fairly. We discussed these comments at final meeting of GRIP this week, and we will take your comments into account, along with those of other respondents, in considering whether to make changes to the draft report before the final version is published in early January. Whilst GRIP does not wish to enter into protracted correspondence on the issue of TCF, which forms a relatively small part of its overall remit, indeed the profession has a separate working party specifically considering TCF and general insurance, we felt it was appropriate to address the specific points that you make. GRIP does not seek to endorse or not to endorse utility pricing. However, it is a fact that this practice goes on and is likely to continue with or without the support of actuaries. Indeed, in many companies, the retail price is set by management while the actuaries advise only on the risk costs. A clear distinction is in many cases maintained between the two. General insurance companies typically seek to deliver a satisfactory return they can deliver to shareholders, and utility pricing is one tool that they use to do this. Actuaries are employed by those companies, either directly or as consultants, and are expected to assist in that ambition. Motor market underwriting results in recent years indicate that insurers are not generally making excessive profits at the expense of customers. The FSA has consistently maintained, most recently in October, in a meeting with the chairman of the profession's TCF working party, the pricing does not fall within the scope of that initiative. practice of utility pricing means that some customers or groups of customers might be charged more than would be suggested by a pure risk-based approach, but conversely, other customers may get a better deal. Indeed, given that different insurance companies have different objectives, strategies and brand strengths, it is likely that in many cases, a customer prepared to shop around would be able to find a lower premium than would be expected from a purely risk-based perspective. In any case, the difference in premiums introduced by utility pricing may be small in comparison to the differences that might be expected between companies because of their differing views on the risk cost, expense basis, profit targets, etc. Customers are well advised, even in the absence of utility pricing, to shop around to identify the best deal. We do not accept that insurers practicing utility pricing are acting in bad faith. Utility pricing is really an extension of the basic economic theory of supply and demand, with insurers charging a price that the customer is willing to pay. The insurer offers to meet contractual obligations under the policy at an agreed price. Both the policy terms and the price are made clear to the customer. Although insurers do not commonly quantify and publish the price difference between new and renewal business, many do indeed make clear that there may be a difference. For example, in advertising discounts for new business sold on the internet or sold within a defined promotion period. Other companies seek to make a selling point of the fact that they do not charge more for renewing customers than at a new business stage. In summary, we agree that utility pricing clearly raises some ethical issues in all areas of life and not just insurance, although it does not fall within the scope of treating customers fairly as defined by the FSA. However, we do not believe that it is a purely actuarial issue, nor indeed one on which the profession can act alone. Individual actuaries are clearly at liberty to form their own views on the rights and wrongs of utility pricing, but for the majority, a duty to enhance value for the insurers that employ them will prevail unless and until the market as a whole moves to cease this practice, either voluntarily or under pressure from the regulator. In the meantime, we consider that the role of the profession should be to raise awareness amongst actuaries of the potential issues so that they can be prepared, firstly, to contribute to any debate that does emerge, and secondly, to amend pricing practice within their own firms if the need arises. That is our response to Guy.
Right, who's going to go next then? Come on, there's lots of people here hoping to get 2 hours of CPD. Kathy, well done.
Kathy Byrne. As you might expect, I'll provide you with some comments on creditor insurance, which I know quite a bit about, having done pricing of creditor for a number of years. This is covered under the Treating Customers Fairly section in Section 8. And the first area I'd like to comment on is pooling of risk or granularity of pricing. I think the working party's got it spot on here in the two distinctions between one end of the set spectrum when you're completely pooling risk and the other end where you're charging an individual rate. And I think the FSA hasn't quite got this concept yet when it's looking at, say, life insurance compared to creditor insurance, and that the way of rating individually is somewhat better. They seem to be missing the point that then that goes away from pooling of risk. The comment about creditor insurance in the paper suggests that there's just one rate for everybody. What we have done previously at my company is we've actually charged rates for a mortgage scheme, which varied by a number of factors, including age, location, employment status, amongst other things. And the variation of rates was something between 2 and 20, so a factor of 10 in difference between the end customer rate. And one of the things that we looked at was, well, can you possibly charge such a wide scale with people do? Will people buy it? So we ended up bringing the scale closer together. And what we found when we actually sold it was we only got business at the lower end of the spectrum at the lower rates. So the question becomes, to what extent you want to cross-subsidise? Do you pool everything and charge everyone the same? Do you do something in the middle? Or do you do something where you're individually rating? The second area I want to talk about, which is a very hot topic at the moment, is competition. As everyone's aware, the Competition Commission are looking at creditor insurance in some detail at the moment. There seems to be some suggestion in the paper that competition doesn't exist in the creditor market. Well, I don't think that's true. It's an extremely competitive market, but the competition happens on a business-to-business basis rather than a business-to-consumer basis. The competition occurs between us as an insurance company providing insurance to a bank or a building society or a lender for their customers. And the deals there are extremely competitive, and the insurance margin is actually quite small, which I think is brought out in the paper. However, nothing is mentioned about the product provider distributor relationship, which is another aspect of TCF that the FSA are interested in. And what we've got here is effectively the insurer acting as the manufacturer and providing the distributor with what they've asked for in terms of giving them the net rate for the cover they've offered. So there's maybe a little bit more that could be done in that area there. The other area where competition does exist, it seems to meant to say there's no direct market. Well, there is a direct market for creditor insurance. People can shop around and have been able to for a number of years. My company and many other companies have direct products available off the internet. Just try typing payment protection insurance into Google, and I'm sure you'll get hundreds, if not thousands, of hits. There seems to be some suggestion here that creditor insurance isn't value for money. I would question, what does value for money actually mean? And it seems to be something in relation to insurance where we get very het up about commission levels. Surely value for money is, does the customer think it's worth the price they're being asked to pay for it? And they have several different options here. They can shop around, look on the internet for different prices, or they can choose not to take the cover out at all if they don't think it's value for money. I don't know whether anyone's been watching The Apprentice like I have, but you can see what Alan Sugar's views are on value for money. They had one exercise where they had to sell sweets in London Zoo, and one of the participants was very uncomfortable at selling sweets for £2.50 when they only cost 20p to make. So it seems peculiar to me that value for money is something that seems to come up in commercial aspects in general insurance and life insurance, but doesn't seem to come up in the same way in other types of businesses. That's all I wanted to say.
Thank you very much, Cathy. Right, who'd like to go next? Come on, someone must. Yes, excellent.
Chairman, ladies and gentlemen, my name is Thomas Alden. I have one quick personal comment, having read the paper, which I thought, let me start by adding my thanks. I think it's an excellent paper and well written. My comments regarding the education section. And I do think it is important the pricing issues do get high profile and are tested at the education stage. But I would disagree with one of the previous comments and the possibility raised in the paper that we have a separate exam. I've recently moved into general insurance from the pensions environment, and I'd sort of draw the parallel with having a separate exam purely for scheme design. I don't think that would be sensible. I don't think a specific pricing exam for general insurance is a sensible idea here. Otherwise, each of the disciplines that actuaries work in could start breaking their discipline into four or five different exams, and sort of where would it end? So that's just my brief comment. I really think it's up to the profession and the GI board and the education board to get the balance right.
Thank you very much. Perhaps while people are thinking, I could just make a few comments on the section on communication. I was delighted to see this section in the paper. I mean, like the lawyer who Derek mentioned in his opening, I was struck by the high quality of the presentations by general insurance actuaries at last year's GIRO conference. And I do think the problem is not so much that actuaries or many actuaries don't have the communication skills, but that we do tend not to spend enough time and effort on thinking about how to present our results to the intended audience. We put all the effort into coming up with the results and not enough into putting them across. I do think this is a difficult area because a typical target audience, such as an insurance company board, will usually cover a fairly wide range of technical skills and attention spans and availability of time to read things. And so pitching something that's right for everyone is pretty tricky. But because it's difficult is not an excuse for not trying, and I do think we ought to recognise that this is a very important part of our work and one that we ought to put more effort into. And I like the idea of collecting together a catalogue of pitfalls and techniques for overcoming them. And I think if such a catalogue were produced, it probably could be used beyond the general insurance area by other actuaries as well. In other words, it might be of general use to the profession. So I very much support producing that. Also, if guidance hampers clear communication, then I think we ought to think seriously about whether that guidance is fit for purpose. And I do think that very long reports can be daunting to readers, even if they're set out in a user-friendly way that takes people through in stages. So if there really are situations where it's necessary to include 1,000 different graphs in order to comply with GN12, then I think there is a potential problem there. But anyway, well done to the authors for including this section, and I hope that the recommendations are acted on. Now, has that given anyone any time to think of other points they'd like to make? Yes. Paul.
Thanks, Nick. Paul Seymour. I should just emphasise that I'm speaking entirely personally and not with my bear's hat on, and particularly about some of the issues which are more in the area of what the profession should do than what one should do from a technical point of view. And these are random thoughts jotted down when Duncan was making his opening remarks. First, the point that I think has been touched on by a number of people, which is how much can you add to the exams and so on without sort of overburdening the system? Or indeed, and this is another risk from my point of view, splitting actuaries into different silos. Because we've seen the CAS in America, for example, and personally I don't think that's a good idea, but as I say, I'm just speaking personally. So I think we do have to balance the degree of specialism, and postgraduate type of behaviour might be some way of dealing with this. Apparently we got good feedback from the stakeholders we spoke to. Now, I suppose my question there might have to be, where are all those stakeholders in this country? Because I have a feeling from what I've read myself that some of the stakeholders in America and or Australia might not be feeling quite so pleased about what actuaries have done for them. But I'd be interested in any comments that the group may have on that. On the communications point, which Nick just touched on, we have put something in our preliminary consultation paper about that, because you will all remember, having read it closely, that Morris recommended that the profession should that the BAS should actually pay some early attention to a generic standard on communication. And in the paper that we've produced, and I encourage you all obviously to read it and preferably also to respond to it, we have actually raised the question as to how you might do that, because it's not quite as easy as it sounds. I mean, it's easy to write things like speak plain English and stuff like that, but I think it was probably supposed to mean a little more than that. And if you combine it with the SAT proposals that, again, Duncan kindly mentioned, it's possible that it's the only way you can do it is to actually say for each output what and how you should communicate. and that there's nothing that you can add at a generic level across the top of it. So that question is raised in our paper, and we would be interested in any thoughts that people might have. Catherine mentioned pricing regulation. Again, in the discussion paper that we've issued, I think you'll find that we, at the moment anyway, are quite averse to that idea. And in that sense, I'm not speaking for Baz because it's in the paper. The commercial, or the two-hat thing that came out of the IAA, and by the way, it confused me on the train coming down because I think of the IAA as the International Actuarial Association, but of course in this context it means the Australians. And I need to study that a bit more because I haven't sort of taken on board exactly how their two-hat system might work. But it is quite close, I think, to some of the things that we're saying about the difference between pure information, which would be sapped outputs, and general advice. And it's a subject that the board has spent a lot of time talking about. And finally, just in a minor response myself to Guy Thomas's comments about the compensation culture paper, I would say, in some response to that, that when I was chairing the Wider Fields Board, we did a lot of work on the Ogden tables, and actually what we were encouraging the law, in effect, to do was to pay a fairer, i.e. higher, amount of damages to people who had been injured in car accidents and so on. So it's not all a one-way street, is all I would say. Thanks, Nick.
Right. Oh, yes. Julian.
Thank you, Mr. President. My name is Julian Lee. Some years ago, I suspect while I was still studying economics, I read that there are two basic ways of buying and selling things. The first, and probably the one that we're most used to in this country, is the shop. You go into a shop, unless it's a very exclusive shop that doesn't descend to such things, the prices of everything is displayed on the article. You can pick up the article and choose to buy it at that price, or you can walk out of the shop either to try to get it more cheaply somewhere else or not to buy it because you don't think it's worthwhile. The alternative is the bazaar. In the bazaar, nothing is priced. You go into the bazaar thinking you might buy something. The stall keeper sees you. He sizes you up and thinks what you might be prepared to pay for this article, and you look at him and decide how much you can beat him down to. And if the one ends up higher than the other, you won't buy it. If it ends up lower, you will. But there's no fixed price. It's just worth what you can get or what you can pay for it. Now, some years ago when I was involved in a GIRO working party on general insurance and the public interest, I mentioned this to my fellow working party members, and one of them said, "Yes, I think that's perfectly good, and it's a very good point to make. But I do want to know, when I go into a place that's selling things, whether I'm going into a shop or a bazaar." And I don't think we've entirely decided in general insurance whether general insurance sells its goods in a shop or in a bazaar. Quite clearly, there are elements of both. Unless we're going for very bog-standard policies that apply to everybody who may buy things. There are very good reasons for prices differing between different people. Unlike most industries, we can sell an identical policy to different people or to different companies, and it has a very different cost of sales. That isn't true, for example, when you're buying commodity goods, except perhaps to a very limited extent, that does tend to be recognised perhaps by bulk discounts or discounts for early settlement. This leads to some confusion. If you go to buy a policy, it does look a bit like a bazaar. Here I am, I want to buy your motor insurance. What will you give it to me for? And although I have to give a lot of detail, and it's quite clear what my policy premium is being based on, it does feel a bit like the bazaar. to the person selling the insurance, on the other hand, he may feel he's in a shop. I've been given all the list of things I need to know. Here's the price. I won't pursue that any further, but I think philosophically, it is the philosophical reason that lies behind a lot of the confusion that we have. I'll just end by adding what we could debate as possibly, or possibly not, another reprehensible practice, and that is certainly in the field of bulk insurance, using the fact that somebody has claimed, or the number of claims he or she has made, as a rating factor. We are all very familiar in that sort of insurance with the concept of the no-claims discount, which sounds excellent. We know that if we don't claim, we will get a cheaper price. We're also now familiar with the concept of the protected no-claims discount, in which, because you have been a customer who's proved a no-claims discount exists, is appropriate for a long period, won't be penalised. However, if the number of claims that has been made or the claims experience in some way becomes a rating factor, then the clarity of the no-claims discount is certainly dulled, shall we say, even if it isn't abolished entirely. If the headline rate depends on the claims experience as well as the discount, then people are not necessarily getting what they think they will get. I don't believe that this is a clear-cut moral yes or no, but I do think it's well worth debating, and it's something that we might like to consider along with the other such aspects of treating customers fairly.
Thank you very much, Julian. Now, do we have another speaker? No? Well, in that case, I will ask Derek Newton. Sorry, not Derek Newton. I will ask David Hindley to close the discussion.
Thank you, Mr. President. Ladies and gentlemen, I first like to begin by congratulating the authors on what could be a first. Just before coming this evening, I thought I'd type in the three words insurance premium rating into Google. And guess what comes up at the top of the list? This paper. And in fact, this evening's meeting comes up as the second item. So well done. I don't know whether you've engineered that or not, but I thought that was fantastic. We've heard a wide-ranging discussion on a topic that I think should be a key component of what we as actuaries do for our employers and clients. Many of you, I'm sure, will have heard of the driving analogy related to an insurance company. It has many variations, but it's usually something along the lines of the marketing department being on the accelerator, the compliance department being on the brakes, and the good old actuary looking in the rearview mirror. Well, whilst we might need to look to the past experience for some premium rating methods, generally, I think the pricing actuary would normally be looking forwards. This, I think, is in contrast to an area that the general insurance part of the profession is probably best known for, reserving, of course, which can, at least for the more mature prior period cohorts, be seen as looking backwards. However, as a profession, I think it's helpful if we are able to show that we can also look forwards rather than backwards. And so, therefore, I think this is an important paper, particularly for the general insurance part of our profession. It provides an excellent and wide-ranging introduction to premium rating. When I originally talked to Duncan about taking on the role of chairing the paper, I was firmly of the view that the paper should focus on the direct market, personal and commercial lines only, since I felt that this was the first area that we as actuaries had got involved in general insurance, and that should rightly be what we should focus on. And to extend it to the London market would, I think, make it too broad. However, having seen the paper, I'm glad that they didn't listen to me, as I think it's all the better for covering such a wide range of classes and probably explains why this room is very full this evening. I particularly liked the models of operation discussion and the table in section 2 of the main paper, since I think it helps us all get a good perspective on the range of different pricing approaches for different classes of business. By being wide-ranging, I think the paper will help general insurance actuaries from across a broad spectrum of the general insurance industry who perhaps have spent most of their careers doing reserving work in its various forms, give them a good understanding of the methodologies and issues involved in premium rating work for a wide range of different classes of business. In terms of the discussion this evening, pretty much every speaker has been supportive of the paper. One or two critical comments, as I think one might expect. I just want to run through some of the key themes that I've heard this evening in the discussion. We've heard quite a lot on the subject of the role of the actuary, and Duncan, I think, highlighted this as one of his two key themes at the start. Catherine Morgan contrasted the role in pricing reserving, saying that she was not in favour of a statutory role, which I think I would agree with. David Hart said that the paper should the arguments in the paper about giving competitive advantage that the insured should have an actuarial report, and he questioned the downgrading on the methods. The paper made two recommendations. Firstly, that there should be a premium rating manual developed on a wiki, and secondly, that there should be research in a number of areas. I think the idea of a wiki is an excellent one, and I think it would show the general insurance part of the profession leading the way if we can create a resource that's of genuine benefit to actuaries and pricing specialists around the world. So I would support that initiative. A number of speakers, I think, also commented on that aspect and were supportive of it. On communication, several people made reference to this, which I don't think is a great surprise. It's rare, I think, for it to not be raised in any general insurance discussions. Initially, I didn't agree with the idea that the profession should get involved in training of the softer skills. However, if you look at the paper, there is a recommendation that we should talk to specialists in this field. My view is that we should do that, and we should give them suggestions as to what sort of areas needed to be addressed for actuaries, but we should leave the professional trainers to actually do the training. A number of speakers highlighted the importance of communication. On the subject of education, the paper makes two recommendations. Firstly, that the ST and SA exams should be enhanced to widen pricing content, and Derek Newton pointed out that that has already started. And they also made several other ideas for development of education material, for example, making use of the CAS material, which I think is sensible. Duncan Anderson commented at the start that he felt all roads led to education, and I think there's some truth in that. A number of speakers were supportive of the idea of enhancing the education syllabus to cover more pricing aspects. Those people that commented on it, I think, broadly felt that it was not appropriate to produce a separate pricing paper, and I would certainly agree with that. On CPD, there was very little discussion from the floor. I felt that the suggestion of a one-day pricing conference is an excellent idea, an annual conference, which I think is something that happens in the US, and I think it would be great to start such an event in the UK. On guidance, the paper makes three recommendations. It firstly says that it doesn't think there should be any more specific guidance, rather there should be a focus on CPD and education. Secondly, it suggests that perhaps there should be more IANs, particularly helping on interpretation of GN12 and GN50 in a pricing context. And thirdly, it suggests, and I think this is quite closely related to IANs, it suggests that there should be perhaps some technical notes on pricing. Duncan highlighted the Australian approach, and a number of speakers, including Paul Seymour, agreed with that approach might well be worth taking a closer look at. Sandeep Chandaria, I think, was right to ensure that in producing these technical notes or IANs, that did not stifle innovation, and I would certainly agree with that. They should not be too prescriptive, in my view. On treating customers fairly, we heard Guy Thomas's comments and the response from the working party. I think it's true to say that the paper didn't make any specific recommendations on this subject. And in fact, if you look at the summary of the recommendations, which is being published, there aren't any specific recommendations, I think, in relation to this area. So The Working Party were, I think, as I see it, expressing their views in the paper, and are not making specific recommendations in terms of how the what view the profession should hold in this. I liked Julian Lee's contrast between a shop and a bazaar. I think that is an area that we should think about further. This evening is not just about treating customers fairly. It is, as I think Carl pointed out, one of the aspects of the paper, but not everything. I think it's right that the profession debates this important social issue, I would encourage those that are interested in this subject to take it forward or to get involved in the existing Working Party. There's a lot in this paper for the profession to consider, including several specific recommendations for actions, and Eric said that the board agreed broadly with all of the recommendations, and I would support that myself. But obviously the profession needs to prioritise which of these actions it takes forwards. From my own personal perspective, I think I'd highlight three priorities, or three areas for initial action, perhaps. Firstly, I think we should move forward with this idea of a wiki. I think that's a superb idea. Secondly, I like the idea of the annual one-day pricing conference to continue to promote the role of actuaries in this important area. And thirdly, research. Yes, we must be seen to be involved in researching various aspects of pricing across a range of different product classes. But I think perhaps we do need more input from the GRIP team on what they think are the priorities for research. When the General Insurance Board created GRIT, we knew there'd be a lot of interest since so many actuaries do reserving. I think it's clear from the audience this evening that there's also a great deal of interest in pricing. And, of course, the two functions should always, wherever possible, be linked in any well-run company. To repeat what I said at the start, I think this paper provides an excellent and wide-ranging introduction to premium rating, and I thank the authors and all those that helped with the paper for all their hard work over the last 2 years in bringing this all together. Thank you.
Thank you, David. I can just visualise people all over the country typing insurance premium rating into Google and coming up with this paper. I'd now like to ask Carl Murphy to respond on behalf of the authors.
Mr. President, ladies and gentlemen, first of all, on behalf of all the members of GRIP, we very much appreciate your comments this evening and the discussion that has been generated. I was actually quite flattered, and I hope the rest of the members were as well, by the almost universal response to the paper, and it certainly made the 2 years that we've spent putting this together well worthwhile. Quite appreciative of the comments, in particular about education and CPD, and the Australian two-hat approach to professional guidance that Duncan highlighted in his introduction. To discuss some of the points brought up by the various speakers, first of all, Derek, you accused us of a lack of imagination coming up with the name GRIP. I think about half of the first working party session that we had came up with lots of different potential names for what turned out to be GRIP. Unfortunately, only one of them was publishable, namely GRIP, and I'll tell you what it really means afterwards, okay? Catherine Morgan brought out the question, not that she agreed with it, but the question about whether there should be a statutory role within pricing, and we agree with her that we feel that this would not be appropriate. I remember attending a CAS conference and speaking on a session several years ago, and obviously at the CAS they do have a much more formal sign-off role within the pricing environment, and I posed to them the question, how many of you feel that you should have this role? Are you in favour of rate filing? And I think about 90% of the audience there felt that they didn't want to have the role. They felt that it impeded them getting close to the business and actually adding value to the clients or our employers. Peter Hinton and Sanjeev Chandaria asked about mentioned about the integration of pricing and ICAs. And as David Hindley alluded to, we have been asked to prioritise our list of research topics for the General Insurance Board, and I think that certainly will be quite high on the list of our recommended first things to cope with. Ryan Warren and David Hart both mentioned about having things like the softer skills, negotiation skills, communication skills as being part of the education syllabus. There was actually quite a debate within one of the gyro sessions which we had. One person brought up the view that surely this should come from yourself or for your employer, not necessarily from the institute. It's not necessarily a view I share, I must admit, but it is a point to consider, I think. Anna Mata mentioned about sort of the lack of product knowledge sometimes within actuaries, and indeed that is one of our recommendations within the education and CPD sections that we agree with her. I think that it would be of benefit for actuaries to increase their product knowledge. Cathy Byrne mentioned The Apprentice. I'm also a mad keen fan of The Apprentice. That lady got sacked, by the way, on that episode, just in case anybody didn't see it. There was a question raised about the education and whether it's feasible or practical to have a single examination on pricing. My understanding of what's currently being explored within the general insurance exams is that there'd be two papers, one covering reserving and capital modelling and one covering pricing and reinsurance. So perhaps that's a good balance between having just a single paper on pricing and making sure that other areas are sufficiently covered as well. Paul Seymour just posed a question where were all stakeholders UK-based. I'm pretty sure that they were. That wasn't necessarily a bias against the Australians or Americans or trying to rig the result. Obviously, the terms of engagement did relate to members of the Institute and Faculty of Actuaries, so obviously there is very much a UK bias there. And a final point, when I was, I very much enjoyed Julian Lee's comments. I always find that general insurance is not just a bazaar, but it's also bizarre as well. We will, of course, have a discussion amongst all of the members of GRIP in due course, and we will obviously include more written comments within the British Actuarial Journal. When we embarked on GRIP almost 2 years ago, there was a general feeling within the group that pricing perhaps hadn't received the sufficient attention within the general insurance community, and perhaps was becoming a bit of a second-class citizen, perhaps to reserving and capital modelling. And this perhaps was highlighted by a distinct lack of pricing papers and presentations at Gyro year after year. Indeed, in the history of the British Actuarial Journal, which I believe started in 1995, there's only been one paper written directly concerning non-life pricing. And to put that within context, that is the exact same number of papers that has been included within the British Actuarial Journal as there has been on mortality trends in Spain. So I'm very pleased that we're here talking about non-life pricing here this evening. Though I believe, I would stand corrected, but I do believe that this is the first sessional presentation on general insurance pricing actually since 1992. Perhaps this is a function of more pressing needs, but pricing is an area where there's no compulsion for stakeholders to use actuaries, and there's certainly a general feeling within the group that we felt it's time that the actuarial profession put it a little bit higher up the agenda, and indeed I think our stakeholders do too. Just before concluding, I would like to just provide an explanation about the way that this paper was published within the British Actuarial Journal. We did just produce a 7 or 8 page summary with a link to the main paper, which obviously was a 190 pages long. The main reason for that was that we did feel that a more sort of formal formatting style of the BAJ is not necessarily most appropriate for this type of paper, and perhaps whoever is in the powers that be when it comes to the British Actuarial Journal perhaps could consider whether if certain papers were more conducive to a different style of formatting, perhaps they could consider that. Finally, just once again like to thank the various contributors that we roped in to help write the paper, to the many contributors at our two sessions at Gyro, and to everyone who spoke this evening, and also to the stakeholders. We did interview those at a very early stage, and they provided a very clear steer to the direction of our work. There is much work to be done to implement the various recommendations of this paper, and I'd like to thank in advance anybody who gets involved in that in the future. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Carl. On that last point about the BAJ, I do have some sympathy with your views, and one of the powers that be is sitting in the front row there, so let's hope that will be taken forward. We've had an excellent paper this evening, well written, easy to read, and with clear recommendations for future work and further action. And it's prompted a high-quality discussion. So I think the authors fully deserve all the plaudits they've received during the course of the discussion. And I'd like to express my own thanks, and I'm sure the thanks of all of us, to the authors, but also the opener, the closer, and all of those who've participated in the evening's discussion. Can we please thank them in the usual way? Now, it would be very helpful for those preparing the transcript of the discussion for the British Actuarial Journal if you could hand in any prepared notes to Pauline Simpson or Maria Lyons at the back of the hall as you leave the meeting. The next meeting will be the annual general meeting, which will take place at Staple Inn on Monday the 2nd of July at 5 p.m. when, in addition to the formal business, Paul Thornton will summarise the findings of his institutional review of the regulatory bodies in the occupational pensions area. Paul has been appointed by the Department of Work and Pensions to lead this review, which is looking at the respective responsibilities of the various bodies, how they fit together to make sure they support government policy and also fit the reform proposals and developments in the pensions market. And not only that, I will be giving an update on the profession's strategy implementation programme. So that's Monday the 2nd of July at 5 o'clock. And the next sessional meeting of the Institute of Actuaries will take place at 5 o'clock on Monday the 24th of September 2007 at Staple Inn, when a discussion on two-dimensional mortality data, patterns and projections will take place. It's an excellent paper which has already been presented at the faculty in Edinburgh and well worth coming along. So that's pretty much it for this evening. I'd like to invite you all to join me to continue tonight's discussion over a glass of wine in the council chamber. And can those seated in the council chamber please pick up their chairs and move them to the sides of the room to allow us to get to the drinks. Thank you very much. I declare the meeting closed.